move, going deep, speed race. He's got Hill! He's got Hill!
From the Baptist Health Studios, inside the Baptist Health Training Complex, this is Drive Time with Travis Wingfield.
He's got it! Miami is in the playoffs!
What is up, Dolphins, and welcome to the Drive Time Podcast. I am your host, Travis Wingfield, and on today's show, we continue the preview series and flip it over to the defensive side of the football with the great Trevor Sikkema from Pro Football Focus. Plus, you guys have some questions. We want to talk about Eric Ezukama, the running back position in general, and also take a look at a review on the podcast up on Apple Podcasts, I believe it was, and finally, discuss the Tua throwing motion video. All of that and a heck of a lot more from the Baptist Health Studios inside the Baptist Health Training Complex. This is the Drive Time Podcast. So that was a video that momentarily broke Twitter. It was Tua throwing a football, right? And I don't think, you know, I don't talk about this a whole heck of a lot, but one thing that I do have my Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours in is throwing and catching baseballs, footballs, any type of sport, ball, including footballs. All I did as a kid was get home from school, go outside in my backyard, and would throw the baseball up to myself and hit it, and then throw the ball against that net that could either propel a ground ball or a fly ball, and I would pretend like I was playing in the major leagues and play these games over and over and over again, or I'd go to the front yard and shoot hoops for 3 hours and do the exact same thing all by myself until I got older. Then my friends would come over and do the exact same thing. So all I did my whole life was play sports, and I can tell you about my own experience with changing a throwing motion. Not quite an NFL quarterback, but close, right? A Legion baseball infielder. Close, right? Very, very close. So I could always hit. That was never a problem. But when the field expanded to big league size, which, by the way, in my day, they made us go from 60-foot base paths and 200-foot fences to 90-foot base paths and 400-foot fences. Where was the middle ground there? I always wondered that. And my high school park actually had a 400-foot dead center fence with a 25-foot tall fence on top of that. Pretty dumb. But I wasn't getting any at-bats or starts my freshman year on the junior Legion team. And I asked the coach, like, Coach, I'm a better hitter than Jake. I'm a better hitter than Eric, the shortstop and second baseman that are playing more than I am. Why am I not playing more? And he said, well, we can't trust you to throw the baseball to first base. And I took that personally. So I got with the assistant coach and we drilled my throwing motion every day for a couple of weeks. I went from a long looping windup to a condensed throwing motion with the ball tight, high elbow, tight to the ear, keep everything tight and condensed, and that should get the ball out faster and add arm strength. And it did add velocity and distance suddenly to my throwing arm. I became our utility guy because I couldn't get out of the lineup with a decent enough throwing arm and a good bat to boot. So that all comes back to say, from watching the side-by-side videos of Tua from last year to this, I see the exact same change. First, the arm slot is different. It's more over the top with a very pronounced elevation in the elbow, and this maximizes the torque you can get from the arm release, but it's more than that. Everything becomes more compact, including the load, the hip clear, and ultimately the release, which is the most important part of it, right? And if you watch last year, when the ball leaves Tua's hand, his base is spread well beyond shoulder width apart. If I can compare it to a golf swing, it's kind of like clearing your hips at the same time as the contact with a club face. If you play, you know you want to start clearing those hips before you get the club face steep and through the zone. So it's a definitive change if you look at it. A lot of people don't remember this, but Joe Burrow actually was the one in the 2020 class that had arm strength questions coming out of college. And he worked with Tom House, and Tua was working with John Beck more than Tom House here, just to let that go by the wayside there. But it's the same idea, the same shift. And look at this quote that I found. Here's a quote. Urban Meyer used to shout, "You throw like a girl," to Joe Burrow at Ohio State. And so Burrow went to Tom House and learned the same motion that both Brady and Breeze perfected. You're sold on that, right? Let's go ahead and get into the article here, because Urban, well, first of all, he was terrible, but he would say things like, "Not enough velocity, Joe. You're a Division III quarterback, Joe. You throw like a girl." And Burrow acknowledged that his arm strength wasn't up to par. He said, "I completely changed the way I throw the football. The entire 3D QB plan is built around four core legs of the performance table: functional strength and conditioning, mechanics and motion analysis, mental and emotional makeup, and nutrition. From there, an athlete's weaknesses are identified and a personalized program is built to fit accordingly." Burrow's problem, the team discovered from the article, had less to do with his actual arm strength than it did his footwork, lower body, and core. Tom Brady, maybe House's most famous and accomplished client, said in a testimonial, "I've been working with Tom House on what's called ground force production, kinetic sequencing, getting the power from the ground, which translates from the ground to your legs, to your hips, to the shoulders, and all the energy is going towards the target," end quote. I mean, that sounds like how I talk about run blocking, route running, everything. It all starts from the ground. Anyway, the story is on The Athletic. Type in Joe Burrow, Tom House, and you'll find it. But just from reading that, like, yeah, it's Tua's base. And JT O'Sullivan has mentioned this. Kurt Warner has mentioned this in his breakdown videos. Tua's misses can almost always point back to the same base issue. But when he's off the top of the drop, hitches up, that's when you get those dimes like we saw to Waddle versus the Jets twice. Tyreek versus the Jets. Tyreek versus the Eagles. Tyreek versus the Pats. Tyreek versus the Giants. Tyreek versus the Panthers. Tyreek versus the Chargers. Tyreek versus the Commanders twice. Tyreek versus the Cowboys. Waddle versus the Cowboys. You get it. He's pretty good. And now it should be even better. I want to get into your questions here shortly, but first I'd like to acknowledge a review on the podcast that I saw. And this comes in from MSMF9, who says, "Travis works for the team, so yes, he knows more about the team itself than most fans, but it isn't necessary to act like everyone who listens are amateur, as he often states. There are plenty of people who know as much, if not more, than Travis. Every podcast Travis likes to throw shade at other podcasts, but never actually calls them out. I find that to be unprofessional and amateur. If you have something to say, don't beat around the bush. Just say it." I actually appreciate that feedback because I did not know it was coming off that way, and it allows me to address things this way. Maybe that's just how you feel, maybe no one else feels that way, but I want to address it and take that matter seriously because first, the amateur comments that I make are about me. I always say my amateur eye. You'll hear me in press conferences ask that from my amateur eye. I'm an amateur because I am. I do get paid to talk about football, but I'm not a coach. I don't get paid to devise game plans and call plays. I respect the hell out of that, and I couldn't do it. I'm not qualified for that. Now, you say I do have access to things that most people don't, and I use the shit out of those resources, buddy. I'm not one for going online and bloviating about things I haven't studied up on. I know it's rare these days, right? That's the other podcast that I crap on, and I crapped on him on Twitter to his face the other day. More on that in a moment. So if I see Bradley Chubb have a rep in a game that I think is cool, but I have a question about it, I'll ask him about how did you develop that catalog of rush moves and get to that point where you exploited this from the tackle in the game. I'll go ask him, and he tells me. That's the best part of the job because I am not McDaniel. I am not Frank Smith. I do not have a PhD on this stuff. I'm trying to learn the best I can. I think I maximize the time and resources that I do have. Now, that said, do other people study coaching clinics? Do they get personal lessons from NFL players and coaches? Do these people watch 20-plus hours of tape a week? I doubt it. I think that differentiates me in a little bit, just a little bit. And so I do think I have a little bit more to say than the average fan. I think there's a lot of, I don't like for baseball and basketball, I don't care about spin rate and, you know, the art of the pick and roll. I just watch the game. I think that's how a lot of football fans are too. So I'm trying to explain to the folks that are somewhat interested, but don't really like want to dive all the way in. That's kind of the needle I'm trying to thread with the content is like, let's get smarter and learn about football, but help explain it in a way that someone that's not as well-versed can understand. That's the only thing I'm going for there. And with full transparency, the reason that I do go, you know, one-on-one on some of the commentary is that that's a note I've gotten from people above me that said, hey, I don't know what you're talking about. Try to maybe include that more in your content. You know, not everyone knows these terms, and you have to explain things for these casual fans that don't want to be more than casual fans. And that's totally fine. I'm that way with every other sport that I watch. That's all that is. It's not meant to be a slight. I want to be inclusive as I can be. I hope that makes sense. Now, you mentioned the shade. And first, I thought it was abundantly clear who I call out frequently on the podcast, right? And I'll tell them this to their face. In fact, I have. I even asked, this is not who I'm talking about now, but Chris Perkins, who writes for the Sun Sentinel, I think, right? And he predicted 9-8 this year. And the team goes 11-6. And he has asked McDaniel if you're like, oh, you're on the hot seat. I'm like, how do you connect those dots? They exceeded your expectations. Now you want them fired too? I did that in front of the entire presser room, and it was a fun conversation. You know where you will not see me calling people out? On Twitter. That is a no-go zone for me, unless Omar says something that makes no sense, then sometimes I'll get in there and clear it up for him, which happens just about every day, it seems like. But that's where I get really annoyed. I think you guys, the fans, I think you are served up a disservice by several voices, but in particular, a couple of voices that we're kind of talking about here in our media. And I've been very clear about who that is. Omar left for a year and came back and then joined another, how should we say, I guess, negative bloviator for clicks type of commentator. I don't know, on a podcast. I don't listen to the podcast. I would never do that. I just see the montages y'all cut up, like Omar going on the Big O Show and emphatically claiming that Wilkins is only good because he plays half the snaps, gets corrected, and then just never acknowledges it and is indignant in his ignorance. Like, I have no time for that. He totally made something up and had no idea about it and tried to present it as fact. Like, and there are so many examples of that, guys, like whether it's on a show and content or just in talking, like in the hallways. And I'm never, ever, ever going to do that. That is taking shortcuts. I think that's taking advantage of your position because you're in a trusted position where people trust your voice and what your eyes can see because no one else can see it for the most part. And quite frankly, I view it as stealing. You're robbing people that are paying for subscriptions or for your advertising base, like whatever it is. I'll never forget training camp 2020 back at Davie. Tua throws this dime, a 60-yard bomb to Jakeem Grant. Omar's podcast partner, who was referenced by name on the podcast last week, by the way, tweets out that Tua held the ball too long and it would have been a sack. I remember this like it was yesterday. Would have been a sack, held the ball too long. And I knew what he was doing. I saw it. I called it out as such on Twitter and said, that's not true. That ball came out as fast as it possibly could have. And he said I couldn't be trusted because I work for the team. It's the obvious, that's the almost de facto response that I get when someone wants to discredit my thoughts and my work. Mere hours later, and maybe your boy had something to do with this, the video comes out on a tweet from the Miami Dolphins. And from snap to release, it's less than 2 seconds. From the time that the center snaps the ball to Tua and the time it leaves his left hand going 60 yards down the field, less than 2 seconds. Allen deletes the tweet. You got caught, bro. I can't stop the grift. I can't do it. But I hope that the audience also listens here. And that's a fact check for them. That's all I'm doing. We good with that? Maybe not, but I'm not stopping. I only have y'all's interest in mind, and I will not stand for indignant ignorance when it comes to this team when I know better. That's all. Let's go ahead and take a break right there, come back on the other side, and get into a couple of questions you guys have from Twitter. We'll do that next here. Drive Time Podcast, your host, Travis Wingfield, brought to you by AutoNation. Let's pick it back up here on this Friday edition of the Drive Time Podcast with a couple of questions from y'all. I'm loving the feedback in the threads or the straight tweets you guys send to me. I'm bookmarking those with the intention of answering them for you, and I will keep an eye on the reviews. I hope that that review segment previously didn't turn anybody off. I just wanted to be transparent with you guys about, you know, what I saw one fan thought, and so I wanted to address that. Yeah, there you go. Let's go ahead and hear from @MikeLaneCC on Twitter. Great content. I appreciate the Dolphins' focus on how you partner with the draft coverage and other news. Obviously, it depends on how the board fell, but do you see us going with depth running back late to prepare for Mostert or Wilson's cliff or departure in 1 to 2 years? I love this question because I think it's a good way to maybe attach a disconnect that I frequently see, and that every year we get a draft pick, and last year it was the first pick we had, right? The cornerback, which 2 years in a row, cornerback has been one of the most banged up positions on a very banged up football team in your Miami Dolphins. But every year there's a draft pick where it's like, they didn't need X, Y, or Z. They needed A, B, or C. And I just don't think that's how teams think, especially when you get deeper into the draft. But I always say, go into the draft with, I must get this or I will not get that, is a good way to have a bad draft. That's not letting the draft board fall to you. And like every year we watch these teams, the Ravens, right? Like they just let the draft fall to them and they wind up getting Isaiah Likely in the fourth round. Like every damn year they do that. And it works out because some name that shouldn't be there winds up there and they're like, okay, bet, we'll take him. And while later on those lines become less rigid, but like, man, if that fifth round pick comes around and you have a perceived need and you have a running back that you think is going to be a player, take the player that you think will be a player. Because if you draft for need, the odds of that guy hitting is what, like 10% at that point of the draft. But if it's a guy that's actually a good football player that is at a position you maybe don't need right now, you increase the odds. And that's just gives you a cheap player for 4 years if you hit on that pick. And I love that you bring up the running back because I think we could play a game tomorrow and I'd be thrilled with what we have in our holster. Now that said, there's also a back that I think makes so much damn sense if you're Miami. If he makes it that far down the board, maybe it's earlier if you acquire a pick via a trade back. But Louisville's Isaac Garendo, and I mean, I'm sure you guys have heard of him by now, but you'll get it when I say this. 4.33 40-yard dash was the fastest among all running backs this year in Indy. He's 6 foot, 221. Interested yet? 41.5-inch vertical, 10.09 broad, a 1-5-4-10 split, a 4-1-5 shuttle, and a 6-9-4-3 cone. He's not like, he's not Achane where he finds those small creases and hits them and explodes through them, but gosh, there's long speed and there's power, and that really translates on tape. He does have good feel and vision and patience, and he knows how to hit the track to hit the proper gap. His tackle breaking ability on the third level is there. He has some patience. I think his initial burst takes a bit to build up, which is why I think there's a chance that he hangs around until day three in the draft. But if he's there, and I love my running back room, I'm prepared to love it even more because I have zero issues grabbing this guy and developing him for a year. Now, he's not the only one. He's just the top one for me in terms of late round options. But yeah, always, always, always keep the light on, Motel 6 style, for talented football players, man. You got to do it. And I think Chris Brooks is a really nice developmental piece from a power standpoint. You mentioned Hefe. He brings some of that as well. And we know what we have in Devon Achane and Raheem Mostert. Savon's a jack of all trades and special teams guy. I just think the draft is too often viewed as a way to shore up weak spots. And I think you shouldn't have that in your mind. I think you should think about this is an opportunity to get guys that can be cheap, productive players for 4 years. And that affords me more flexibility in my contract extensions. It affords me more ability to be aggressive in free agency. It just makes everything better when I have a $700,000 player playing like a top 20 player his position. It works out great for you. But I'll absolutely also just the idea of adding to a strength is also a good way to make your football team better. How can I make the team better? Do that with every decision and you'll have good results. Great question, Mike. Let's get to another one here from at Fins Up Tua. And I actually just saw this guy, not Fins Up Tua, but the guy we're going to talk about in the breakfast line, and he is chomping at the bit to play some football. Since you were talking about wide receiver today, he asks, where do you think Eric Ezukama comes into play next season? Love the podcast. Well, thank you for that. So we know that someone on this team is going to come from out of nowhere, Randy Orton, right? And be a big part of what this team accomplishes or does not in 2024. It happens every damn year with every team. Remember Malcolm Rodriguez for the Lions during their Hard Knocks season? Even the linebackers coach, Kelvin Shepard's like telling the veterans, like, you guys are going to leave me no choice. I'm going to have to play Rodrigo because he's out playing y'all. It happens every year. You sign like Russell Wilson over Matt Flynn. You guys remember that? I know you guys were, I know we were all part of the Matt Flynn, like, get him to Miami under Joe Philbin. Yikes, what a mistake that would have been, but would it have mattered? Because it didn't matter what we did anyways because he's a terrible football coach. But Russell Wilson was a third-round draft pick who was undersized, and he beats him out in training camp. Do you think anyone saw that coming? You know, Kader Kohu was a name that nobody outside the organization was privy to, except for our guy Emery, who does the podcast and gets it right every year. But you get what I'm saying. I don't think a lot of fans would have predicted an Austin Jackson in-season extension coming off of 12 weeks of damn good football or whatever it was at that point. So it's going to happen. And that entire preamble is a way to tell you that I think that Eric Ezukama is, if not at the very top of that list for me, very close to the top of that list. I thought we saw glimpses last year, just like I did with Austin in 2022 before the injury, you know, camp and preseason, there were some good reps there. I think there's a unique skill set in terms of getting into your screen swing game, your backfield alignments. And then I think about him running the football on that end around, going for 50 yards in the preseason, or the slot fade 2 years ago when he mosses a cornerback as a rookie. I remember those reps in the two games last year. Remember the Texas Tech tape where he, quite frankly, was essentially kind of what Malachi Corley at Western Kentucky this year is. I think the world of Ezukama's skill set. I think year three in the offense, maybe a little bit more maturity there. With Coach Welker, I think you could expect probably a decent amount of mastery of what he's doing, or at least a better understanding of what he's doing, where he's supposed to be, all of that. So I think, yeah, Eric Ezukama is kind of an ace up the sleeve, and we do make the move for, if we do make the move for OBJ or draft someone from this awesome class, all of a sudden, Reek Waddle with the rookie or OBJ and then Eric Ezukama. I like that room a whole heck of a lot, and just not the top two guys, but the entire group, and you include Braxton and River Craycraft in there as well. So great stuff to guys. Let's go at great stuff to guys today, guys. Let's go ahead and get to my guest next on the Drive Time Podcast, Trevor Sikkema, brought to you by AutoNation. Joining us today, longtime friend of the podcast, previous and current affiliation, which of course now is Pro Football Focus, and the host of NFL Stock Exchange Podcast, outstanding name, by the way, Tampa Bay Trey. Trevor, what's up, buddy?
Travis, it's good to be with you, my friend. I'm excited to talk a little NFL draft here with you, a little Miami Dolphins football. This is a great time of year, getting to actually put these prospects to certain teams and talk about possibilities. Man, I'm excited for it.
You know, you gave me two options when I asked you to do the podcast about position groups. I'm going to go with the edge group with you, and here's why. I think there's a potential for a really, really really good edge prospect being there at 21. And although we have three that I think are damn good right in our backyard behind me here, accomplished players, you know, Jalen Phillips, Bradley Chubb, Shaq Barrett, why not four, right? I think it serves Miami in that you can get an impact player for 2024, but one of those guys is 31, another is 27. And does it feel like Bradley Chubb is like way older than 27 years old? I feel like he's been in the league for a decade now.
I was literally just about to click on him to see what his age is, because I would have guessed 29. Like that would have been my guess with Bradley Chubb, because you're right. It feels like we have just been talking about him for forever, and I feel like he's been able to hit his stride a little bit with Miami, so it's good. I mean, him being only 27, that's fantastic for them, obviously.
Yeah, it's like I see, like, you know, the ACL, can he be the same? It's like, guys, he's in the peak of his athletic like prowess. Like he should be just fine there. But either way, I digress. So the whole point of that long-winded question is to say, tell me about the edge group at 21. Who is for sure gone in your opinion? Who could potentially slide to that spot? And if they make it there, who do you like for Miami at pick 21?
Yeah, I mean, Miami's interesting, right? Because you mentioned like they've got some guys there that are really talented football players, but just some injuries amongst the group. You know, Shaq Barrett's getting a little bit older. Obviously, Shaq Barrett played in Tampa, so I watched a lot of him as a Bucs fan growing up. So that's a team that I pay very close attention to. And obviously, Shaq was great when he first got there with the Bucs. But since the Achilles injury, you just got to understand kind of what you're getting. And I think a rotational, really smart pass rusher, that's where you're getting from him. But if you want to up the explosiveness there, when you talk about Miami picking at number 21, it's interesting because I would tell you that there's three edge rushers in tier one. I think Laiatu, the pass rush specialist, just like a karate black belt master with how he uses his hands and gets into the backfield. Best pass rusher in all of college football over the last 2 years. No question about it. Incredibly productive and efficient. He's in that category, but his athleticism is a little less than the other two guys. Dallas Turner from Alabama. He's a little bit younger, crazy athlete. Super long arms, basically like exactly what you would want in a build for a pass rusher. He's just still trying to get there with the nuances and some of the technique and really mastering that pass rush profile. But he's somebody to invest in more as like a stand up outside linebacker. And then if you want more of like that heavy handed kind of hand in the dirt 4-3 defensive end, or honestly, like a guy who plays, I think, like a Bradley Chubb does with a lot of power, it's Jared Verse. Jared Verse, one of the most powerful defensive ends prospects in this class. So all three of those guys, to me, have a chance of being available at 21. I think Dallas Turner's the least likely just because, you know, we talk about him maybe coming off the board at number 8 for the Falcons. And so some people might be listening to this and they're saying, whoa, if we're thinking he could go off the board at 8, why would we think he's available at 21? Well, here's the thing. I do a lot of mock draft exercises and I try to like think about realistically what these teams would go for. And sometimes just talent and overall potential trumps whatever like team needs you might have. But there's so many good offensive tackles. There's so many good wide receivers. There's so many good corners. There's great quarterbacks. Like, we know it's going to define the top of the draft. It's realistic to think these really good edge rushers who could all be worthy of top 15 picks could just slide down a little bit because of the nature of how talented this draft is and how deep it is at the premium position. So I would say that Dallas Turner probably the least likely to get there at 21. Verse could have a chance depending on, you know, if teams pass on him because he's not as much of a stand-up rusher as he is, you know, a hand-in-the-dirt type of rusher. And then with Latu, I'm not really sure. Like I mentioned, best pass rusher in this class, no doubt about it. But, you know, he had a neck injury at Washington before he went to UCLA. And that neck injury that he suffered during spring football, Washington like medically retired him. They're like, hey, you know, we're not comfortable with you playing football anymore. We're going to medically retire you. And I actually got to talk to Latu a little bit about it. And he was shocked by that. Like, he understood that he was probably going to have surgery and it was going to be a long road, but they were like, yeah, we're going to medically retire you. You're done. And he's like, well, that's like all this is happening so quickly. So obviously he does his research. He goes to a great surgeon, gets the surgery done on his neck. UCLA actually works with the surgeon that did his surgery on his neck. And so like they were very comfortable with the rehab process and the procedure. So he ends up transferring over to UCLA. He's played the last 2 years, has been injury free there, but does that neck injury being in his history scare teams a little bit? Does it push him down a little bit? He's not as good of an athlete as Verse or Turner is as well. But if you want to make a major splash at edge rusher, I think one of those guys could be available for them at 21. I really do.
Gosh, I lit up when you mentioned Latu because First of all, I knew who he was, but my first real exposure was watching, I think my Washington State Cougars were like 4-0 or 5-1 at some point in the year. And Cam Ward was rolling. He was just cooking all season. And then Latu shows up and wrecks the entire game offensively for the Cougs. And they never bounced back from that. And then I watch him at the Senior Bowl and they couldn't block him there. Like, he's so, so dang good. I love his game so much. And like the similarities with like the injury, the medical concerns going back to college with Jalen Phillips, the fact that he played at UCLA, the number 15 jersey, like it just matches for me in so many ways. And so he's the guy that I love. You mentioned Jared Verse. I think that he goes early too. So like there's some good options there, man. Then you got like Chop Robinson is a guy that is out there. Darius Robinson is a guy that I like a lot, and they're kind of different players. But I wanted to follow up with you on that question because you mentioned, you know, Latu is so polished. Like, gosh, the Senior Bowl, right? He was showing you moves, counter moves. And he fakes the fake. And then you got a guy like Chop Robinson who just has like Cam Wake leaping and get off and burst ability, but maybe the tape isn't as good. How do you, and then also, I guess, how teams might try to stack that? Like, how do you stack polish versus upside, especially at this junction of the draft where like it's not the top of the draft, but you're still in the first round?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a balance and it's always situational. I don't say that to kind of like tiptoe around the question, but like, you know, if you're drafting an edge rusher in the first round and you need to come in, you need him to come in and play right away. Well, if you draft a player who is in a developmental stage, even if he has a really high ceiling, like that might not be what your team really needs, or you just might have to understand like, hey, I have to be patient here. You know, I'm wary of Chop Robinson because as much as he has a really high pass rushing grade in our grading system, he just doesn't have a lot of backfield production, doesn't have long arms, has shorter strides. Yes, he's extremely explosive, but he's not really built to defend the run. He's not really built to set the edge. He's really just kind of I'm going to win off of athleticism right now, which very clearly works for him because he is an unbelievably gifted athlete at his size. And it's working at the college level. The NFL is a lot more difficult. Offensive tackles, they get stronger, they get faster, but more importantly, they get smarter. And if you don't know exactly what you're doing with your hands, if you don't know how to set them up, they're just going to be able to blanket you. You might get them once, you know, but you need a first round edge rusher to be able to give you more of a threat in that regard. Now, all that to say, I am hesitant with Chop Robinson in the first round, but for a spot like Miami, this makes sense, right? Because in theory, when the guys are healthy, you've got two guys that are studs in Bradley Chubb and Jalen Phillips. You can allow Chop Robinson to really just kind of come in these pass rush specialist situations early on in his career. And then, you know, obviously Bradley getting hurt later in the season. If you need Shaq Barrett to play right away, you got a veteran presence right away who can play for you. And Chop can still be in that more pass rush specific rotational role to start off his career. And you can kind of develop him from there.
I mean, I got to say, I feel like content creators that don't, you know, wear the logo that don't work for the team. Cause I'm a big fan of the Dolphins offseason. Like, I think Kyle Fuller was a great addition. Jordan Brooks, the defense has made a lot of additions up front. T.R. Tart was a nice add, but I feel like for content creators that have seen them kind of pick apart their holes that they had going into the draft, and it creates all this flexibility for what they could do. It could be a certain position. It could be a hit now guy, a developmental guy down the road. Like, there's so many variables the Dolphins could throw their hat into here with this upcoming draft. And one thing I want to ask you about, because we talked about Jalen Phillips, and you know, we love Jalen Phillips as a stand-up, like a true 6-7-9 technique, a guy that can play out wide of the formation. But I've also seen him condense Trevor down to the 3 technique and run over a guard, you know, like just bull rush a guard. We've seen Christian Wilkins for years win from that 3 tech position that he primarily plays, but also play a heavy 5. Like, I want to know from this draft who you think is the best player that can do those things. Who's the guy that can play a 5 technique and condense inside and be a nickel rusher, but also a guy who can do the reverse, who's maybe a defensive tackle, which gets away from the position group we're talking about here, but someone that can play inside and then maybe kick outside and play some end as well.
Yeah, there's two specific players at edge that I think of immediately when you bring up that question. You brought up Darius Robinson from Missouri. I think he is one, right? He's somebody who started his career first 3 years when he was at Missouri. He was actually a defensive tackle. Then they had him lose a little bit more weight and they wanted him to be more powerful, like defensive end type. He's kind of lost and gained weight like throughout the draft season. You know, he lost a little bit of weight for the Senior Bowl and the combine, but I think he's bulking up a little bit more from his pro day. At least that was the reports that I kind of heard. And so, you know, he's probably going to play somewhere between, I don't know, you know, low 280s to maybe right around the low 290s. It just depends what a team is going to want to do with him. And he's somebody who really powerful player. Now, we saw at the combine, he's not this rare athlete. Like, he's got explosiveness for his size. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, he still ran one of the slowest 40s of the edge rush group. Like, it's not like this dude's a total freak show when it comes to athleticism. You still got to operate in the realistic world here and say, all right, he's a plus explosive defensive end, but he's not really this guy that's going to, you know, get off the ball and hit outside shoulders and really like bend around the edge against some of these guys. But all that to say, he's got the defensive tackle background and the strength profile, really strong football player, really big work ethic, kind of a high energy dude to play as a five technique, but also kick inside the three. I'd say the same thing about Brandon Dorlus from Oregon. He's somebody who you don't have to draft him in the first round. You could wait a little bit and you could get that type of versatility with. His story is almost parallel to Darius Robinson, where he played defensive tackle early on for Oregon, lost a little bit of weight, played more as a sort of like a 3-4 end. You know, he'd play anything from a 5 technique to a 4-eye. He'd play a little bit of 3 technique. And he too has this plus movement skills and explosiveness for a player who's sort of in between weights. You know, he'd be a bigger edge rusher, but he'd be a little bit smaller of an interior defensive lineman. And you can sort of get in trouble there because we all love to preach versatility, but I think on the opposite side of the coin, things that people don't love to talk about during the draft season is if you don't have a home-based position, then I say that you are homeless. And that is a bad thing to be because if you are just a versatile player, but while you're honing your skills at multiple positions, if I can't go, okay, hold on. You're struggling a little bit here. Let's make sure that we can keep your confidence up as a football player as you go through failure and growing pains. I'm going to give you a couple of reps at 3-tech. Like, get back to 3-tech, remind yourself you're good enough to play this game, make a couple of plays, and then we'll kind of continue to expand there. When you don't have that with these players, you get in a dangerous spot where these guys start to fail too often. They start to lose their confidence. They start to fluctuate weight because they don't know how to play best at what position and all these kinds of things. So that is something that to me doesn't get talked about enough when you talk about defensive line versatility and really any sort of positional versatility. But those two players, I think Darius Robinson and Brandon Dorlus, I think can have those home position type of plays there.
That's an interesting perspective there because I always felt like offensive line kind of gave you some, you know, some security, some backup security in terms of if the tackle doesn't work out, maybe he has a chance to play guard. Like Robert Gallery always comes to mind as a guy that didn't work out a tackle and became a really good guard at the top of the draft many, many years ago. Deion Jordan comes to mind as a guy that didn't really have a secondary option as a guy that didn't work out here for the Dolphins. So plenty of options when you talk about all those different factors that Trevor's discussing there. I also wrote down Darius Robinson, if he's on my football team, he's first off the bus, although Jalen Phillips might be that too. So I have a couple of guys now if I have him. But I think about, you mentioned Dorlus. I want to talk about second round here in a second. But you talk about Robinson and Dorlus. Like, I keep thinking about what Anthony Weaver had in Baltimore with Brent Urban, who was like a 300-pound, like, you know, 5/3 technique, or Roderick Washington, or even Justin Matabuike, who just got paid, by the way, who plays a lot of D-tackle but also kicks outside too. Like, I think that basically it sounds like Darius Robinson and Brandon Dorlus are kind of those guys that fit that mold. Is that kind of what you mentioned there?
Yeah, it feels like for a long, long time now, I mean, coaches have kind of come and gone, like defensive coaches and everything, but for a long, long time, the Ravens defensive line identity, at least for the guys that have their hand in the dirt, has been, okay, we have our dude in the middle. Like we have our nose tackle player. And then the other guys around them are very versatile. They might be in a 4-eye. They might be in a 3 technique a little bit closer. We might kick them all the way out to 5. And so it always felt like those were the two types. You were either just a super stout nose tackle and we could put you in the middle of the defensive front, or you're somebody who we're basically going to align you in a lot of different formations. And so if that's the same thought process coming to Miami, again, that's where we get into the guys like Rook, guys like, you know, Darius Robinson, guys like Dorlus, like where you just have so much versatility on the inside of where you might be aligned, and you figure out, hey, what works best? What's the perfect spacing between you and the nose tackle? Can you play with a lot more space in you? Can you take double teams with tackles and maybe a guard? Can you hold up well enough? You know, all of that still goes into it, but
it's really like a melding of defensive tackle, defensive end, because we've talked a lot of D tackle already here, because I think about, you know, the Dolphins signed T.R. Tart, who I think is a really good, maybe a little bit undersized, a really good nose tackle who got a lot of wins there for the Titans and Texans the last couple of years. And then Benito Jones comes back as kind of a run-stuffing defensive tackle. But then you got, you know, Zach Sealer, I think, is one of the most underrated players in the entire National Football League. But then you also add Neville Gallimore, Jonathan Harris. Like, they just continue to add pieces to this front. So they have so many guys that can do multiple things. So that tracks as well. And this, I wrote this question before we had the conversation. So I was going to say, this is where you earn your money, Trev, but you've already been killing it for us. You've already earned that, that, you know, the, I guess, what's the theoretical dollars that don't actually come to your way. Cause it's
you're helping a buddy.
but anyway, I said, pay the man, increase his wage. But day two edge prospects, you mentioned Brandon Dorlus. I haven't quite gotten that far personally. I'm just curious who you think is in play besides Dorlus at the 55 range.
Yeah, so, you know, you start to have a little bit different conversations, right? Because we talked about the players who could be quote-unquote edges, who are bigger, who you might want to have more as, like, defensive linemen. So, I don't know, maybe they're listed as defensive ends, but they're playing a lot more inside the five technique spot than outside of it. And so those are a couple of dudes. You know, I wonder about, like, Marshawn Neyland as well. I'll throw his name in there from Western Michigan. Kind of the same thing, a little bit bigger of an edge player. I think he weighed at the combine right around like 270, 275. So again, a little bit lighter. He's more of an edge than those guys, but his game's all about power. So I could see them maybe saying, hey, let's throw five more pounds on you. You could be like a Darius Robinson, like a Brandon Dorlus, somebody like that. So I would throw his name into there. If you're looking for more like true edge rush outside linebackers, guys that I don't know if they're, I don't know if these guys are going to be like second round type of a player, but just somebody that, for Miami specifically, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. A second round edge that you would want to keep your eye on is Chris Braswell from Alabama. Mm-hmm. Now he's playing opposite of Dallas Turner, and his, you know, his whole thing is big time athlete as a stand up outside linebacker, but he didn't come into Alabama as a stand up outside linebacker. He actually came in as a defensive end, had his hand in the dirt in a lot. They wanted to make him an outside linebacker. They wanted him to rush from a 2-point stance. He lost a little bit of weight, but it's taken him a little bit of time to be comfortable from a 2-point stance, but man, devastating speed to power player. I mean, this dude's got crazy explosiveness. When he gets off the ball, he gets those long arms into your chest. I mean, he can forklift some of these offensive tackles that he's going up against, and they just can't anchor because he's so powerful. The rest of his pass rush profile, we're still kind of figuring it out, right? I think that we're still really trying to master a club rip, a speed dip to the outside, an inside move, you know, an arm over, something. Like, that is not in his repertoire as much right now, but it can be. And again, for Miami, if you're drafting a different position in round one and you still want to hit edge round two, again, I don't think I'd love Chris Braswell for a lot of teams that would want him to play right away. But Miami is a great setup, a great situation, a great rotation. I think he'd be a great draft and develop type of a player who could even give you some stuff in year one.
This is why you got to check out the NFL Stock Exchange podcast with Trevor Sikkema, because, I mean, that type of knowledge of all 32 teams and who fits specific needs like that, really good stuff there, man. And if you earned your money there, we're going to earn it even more for the last question here. Just real quick, I told you a half hour, a couple minutes left. Go ahead and give me a couple of names here. We have a big gap between our second pick at 55 and our third pick at 158, not till day three in the fifth round. Do you have some day three? We have a fifth, two, six, and a seventh. Do you have some day three options you like at the edge group for Miami?
Yeah, I mean, there's a handful of names that I like. And actually, I was going to start, the reason why I had kind of went back to Chris Braswell is because there were a couple of guys like Xavier Thomas, who I like for them, Jalix Hunt, who I like for them, but they're probably going to be like third round guys, maybe fourth round guys. And I was like, oh, wait, Miami doesn't have a third or fourth rounder. So I had to kind of move on there and pivot and say, well, they're not going to go in the second round. But a guy like Chris Braswell is. So when you think about these day three rushers, now, obviously, these are players who, it's not all sunshine and rainbows with them. There's a reason why they're a day three pick. They're kind of specialized. If they get their hands on a guy like Gabriel Murphy, I'd absolutely love it. You know, he was teammates with Latu. Him and Latu, you could tell, been in the pass rush lab. I mean, he's so quick with his hands. He's keeping offensive linemen from really getting hands on him and staying blocked. You know, he's just not quite the athlete, doesn't have that length, doesn't have that consistency, but the hand usage is fantastic. I think he could be a good specialized pass rusher if you can get him in the fifth round. Javonte Jean-Baptiste, I like as well. He's a former four-star outside linebacker, played at Ohio State for a handful of years. Just couldn't crack that lineup, especially once Jack Sawyer and JT Tuimoloau got on the team. Like, those two guys were going to be the main edge rushers. So Jean-Baptiste ended up transferring over to Notre Dame. And I think he is, again, a really nice stand-up, explosive outside linebacker type that could be available for you in the fifth round. As we keep going here, I mean, Braden McGregor from Michigan is a, man, was he a former five-star? I think he might have been. Four-star or five-star? I mean, he was a highly touted recruit, but he ended up tearing his MCL, PCL, and meniscus his senior year of high school. So, like, the first 2 years of him being in Michigan were basically just rehab. Like, just get your confidence back. Third year, he starts kind of getting in the mix as a rotational edge rusher. Last year was his first year as a full-time edge rusher. And, man, I mean, like, the dude plays really hard. And I think that he's a good run defender. He's just not super long, has really short arms. So I think that, like, that goes against him. He's just losing that length battle too often. He's not a super strong dude either. He's more of a light speed rusher type. But, again, day three guy to maybe get in a rotation there. I think he knows what he's doing with his hands. Obviously, he was a highly touted recruit for a reason. It's that athleticism, but he's got to get a little bit stronger.
I really like the idea of going to that position this late in the draft, because Miami, I love the top of the room, but besides, like, Cameron Good, they don't really have really many developmental edge guys that they're kind of working on building into, you know, potential long-term plays there. So it seems like this could be a good time to kind of replenish the youth and just kind of developmental aspect of that group. And you gave us some great names there. Thanks as always, Trevor Sycamo, Pro Football Focus, NFL Stock Exchange Podcast at Tampa Bay Trey, three sides minimum. Thank you so much for your time today, Trevor. I appreciate it, man.
Appreciate it, brother. Anytime.
And away he goes. Big thanks to Trevor there from Pro Football Focus breaking down this year's class of edge rushers on Monday. I think we're going to go, I'm not quite sure yet, D-tackle or running back. We'll find out. You guys will find out when the podcast comes out. But in the meantime, you all please be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast from. Go ahead and leave us a rating. Leave us a review. Tell us what you think. I'll address it on the podcast. Also, give me a follow on social at Wingfield NFL, the team at Miami Dolphins. Check out the Fish Tank podcast with my guy Seth and Juice. Check out the YouTube channel, my debut hosting efforts on Dolphins today. It's going to be on YouTube, going to be on Local Valley. Check that out, as well as media availabilities, the drive time interviews, and so much more. Last but not least, MiamiDolphins.com. Until next time, fins up, Caroline and Cameron, Daddy, coming home.